Welcome to season 4 of And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy And the Writer Is, please rate and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's legendary producer, writer, philanthropist, friend is a multi-Grammy nominated, multi-Grammy winning, multi-platinum selling mastermind. He's produced on some of the biggest albums in the past 25 years and most recently collaborated on the greatest soundtrack the UK has ever had. With a jazz, classical, musical, theater background, this guy has reached the highest peaks in the pop world and doesn't have to apologize to nobody for it. With co-writers like Adele, Pink, Katy Perry, Celine Dion, OneRepublic, no wonder he's been so successful for so long. His recording plugins are fabulous. His writing camp in France is fabulous. His activism is fabulous. But he's most importantly a good father. All the way from Ontario, Canada, this guy co-wrote one of my favorite songs I've ever written, Small World by Idina Menzel. And the writer is someone who finally agreed to do this podcast, Greg Wells.
Wow. I got nothing after that.
I mean, there you go. And that's the end of the show.
We're done.
The show.
Thank you.
So how does a guy who's born in Canada end up here? That's sort of the first leg of the story.
You know, I think being dysfunctionally focused on a thing that I wanted to find and had no idea where it was.
Explain.
I just sort of popped out obsessed with music, with rhythm in particular.
How old?
Like popped out of my mother, like, you know.
Well, no, I mean, I get the reference of popping out. I assumed it wasn't out of like a jack-in-the-box situation, but like,
kind of was actually. But.
Maybe it was. But I mean, when do you know that, oh, I'm actually, when I'm banging on plates and I'm banging on tables, when is it that somebody says, well, if you hold these sticks, I guess you could use your hands anyway, but when you hold these sticks and you put this human in front of a drum kit, you know, this person could actually play something. Like, how old are you when you realize, oh, this is music and not me just liking rhythm?
Well, the message I was given when I picked up drumsticks was, please put them down. And then if no one said that to me, they would immediately say, please stop drumming. It's too loud. We can't hear ourselves talk about the weather. So this was really like, I mean, I really like walked backwards into all of this. You know, I didn't have it modeled for me at all. Like my kids are having it modeled for them because they're interested in music. But my dad was like a minister in it's called the United Church of Canada. It's like a Protestant. It was like Methodists and Presbyterians and sort of that. And they all got together like 150, 170 years ago and formed this big umbrella thing. So that was what he did. And there was some music in the church, most of which I didn't like. You know, it was more like Church of England, like, it wasn't like cool American, more gospel, more modern, more contemporary vibes. my dad would always say, like, the American churches really get it right, the music. They really get the music right. And it keeps the demographic of the congregation less, you know, gray-haired. But he didn't really know how to pull that off. He was interested in it. He knew, you know, we could see we got a lot of American TV. So there was music, and I enjoyed playing it. And I still, I mean, even as a mix engineer now, my reference is still sort of looking at the front of my dad's church, like the stage of it. I never pan things hard left and right. I want to feel like I'm looking at a performance in that venue.
Interesting. So the not panning it far left and right, the idea that then you'd have, it's as if somebody's speaking directly to you and that the whole band is much closer.
I want to feel like I'm watching a really great performance. I want to, I mean, it's so hard, you know, with speakers, like all we have is the sound. We don't, there's no visual.
As a minister, did he sing?
He was a pretty good singer. Yeah, he loved to sing.
What about your mom?
My mom loves music, but like wasn't, you know, I don't come really from a musical family.
Sure.
They liked singing. They would sing like hymns and like really, there's a lot of like 60s folk music that was became religious. We had a few records by the Medical Mission Sisters, nuns playing acoustic guitars, and it just used to make my skin crawl musically. I mean, I'm you know, no disrespect to them, it's not their fault, but for whatever reason I wanted to hear like James Brown and the Jackson 5. And so when I did, this is kind of answering your question from a couple minutes ago, every so often on the three channels that we got in the 70s when I was a little boy in Peterborough, Ontario, there'd be some blast of like the Jackson 5 performing or Soul Train on Saturday afternoons, which I would watch. I would try to watch it every weekend. And that music just clobbered me over the head and took me over. And I wanted to be on Soul Train as a dancer. And I didn't know what it was. And that aesthetic and that music and that culture really was not around me in a rural factory town, very white, you know.
Were your parents, I mean, from your father commenting that American churches had it right musically, and as a Jew, I can relate to that because we have the worst music ever, which is why we write Christmas songs, you know? It's like, because, you know, we also grew up with nothing, musically speaking. All the Jews ended up being pop writers, as you know that too. You know, so yeah. these people were just grasping for any kind of music that wasn't what we grew up with. Mm-hmm. But in my case, I know my parents were really encouraging of the kind of music I was into, for the most part. Were your parents encouraging with the, you know, Soul Train vibe, or were they agnostic about the kind of music you were inspired by?
I think they thought I was charmingly crazy. Yeah, they didn't. No one ever said stop dancing
right
naked around the house at the age of five, pretending to be Michael Jackson. But they were like,
"Did you really want to dance, though? Do you?
Oh yeah.
Do you dance now?
Not at all. Terrible.
Yeah. When did just the vision of you dancing around naked is very funny to me.
Like right now.
Yeah, it'd be totally the weirdest interview. It'd be like, wait, Snowball, let me show you. Well, no, don't. So, when do you actually see, this is a music teacher? Did you have music in schools? I mean, when is the switch from, oh, I like this, to I'm gonna play?
Well, we had an upright piano that my parents bought for $300. It was used when they bought it before I was born, and that was in our basement. So I would pound on that. That was like my first drum set. And then I started, you know, pounding away, like playing notes on it. Similar story to a lot of people that grew up with a piano in the house. And at the age of, and my mom taught me like a bit of like reading kind of rudimentary stuff when I was in kindergarten, like 5, 6 years old. And then we heard about a really cool piano teacher in my hometown named Marjorie Engels. And I started studying with her when I was 7. And half the lesson, 15 minutes, was like Bach and Beethoven. And the other half was Boogie Woogie. And I think she recognized that I was a frustrated drummer who didn't have drums, but playing Boogie Woogie was like a nice entry point into jazz. It was also super rhythmic, and I loved that, and it kept me going to her. And then helped me get interested in the more classical end of things too, which I had no interest in as a 7-year-old. But by the time I was 9, I did. And then got way, I was wound up, it looked like I was going to do that professionally, like be a concert pianist when I was 14, 15. And she started that whole path.
When you're playing, you know, and I was a below average at best piano player. So I wasn't wowing anybody when I was playing school. I would have to sing something. And I always admired the people who could sit at a piano whenever there was a piano around and just kind of rip and have people just, you know, it doesn't seem to matter who the person is who's playing it. They feel the music and they feel close to it. Did you find that being in a way, a prodigious piano player, you know, I've seen you play, so I know how good you are. When you were playing at 14, 15, you were like, this is probably where I'm going to go professionally. Did the other students and other kids and other parents in your hometown realize how unusual that is? Were they enamored with your musicality the way I kind of envisioned these people to be?
I'll never know. I definitely didn't. It's just a sob story. It's like I should be playing violin while I tell this whole thing. But I never knew I was good at music until I left my hometown. No one ever said to me, I could be wrong, but I really don't remember anyone ever saying to me, oh, you're really good at this. You should maybe consider doing this for your career. When I went to Humber College, which is a college that has a great contemporary music program in Toronto, then I started getting that message. And I actually got, it sort of did my head, and I'm like, why was I never told this before? I knew I was obsessed with music.
But they didn't know there was a profession either. I mean, when one of the first people I signed as a publisher, I talked to their parents, and I said, you're used to hearing this incredible voice in your house, so you think that other people have daughters that can sing like that. But I'm telling you that that's a world-class singer and writer in your household, and you're busy worrying about the wrong thing. You don't realize it, what you have, because you think your child is like every other child. Your child isn't like every other child. I'm telling you that now, you know? And it like, but it took somebody from the outside saying that to somebody's parents.
I remember walking in, I might start crying talking about this, but I remember walking into my dad's office at the church that he worked at. And there was a guy who I'm still friends with, actually just bought a Telecaster from him that is the guitar I learned how to play on because he would lend it to me all the time. And he was a musician, great singer, good guitar player, lovely dude. He was a school teacher. And he was a member of my dad's congregation at that church. And he was really supportive. He'd lend me this beautiful Fender Tele all the time. And it's how I began to pick up guitar. And I walked in after Sunday service to my dad's office just to get my coat so we could go. And I walked into the two of them having a heated argument, which I'd never seen. Like I'd never seen, other than my own parents, I'd never seen grown-ups kind of voices raised. And I walked into this guy saying to my father, I can't believe you won't buy him drums. And then they saw me and they stopped and the conversation ended. But clearly they were both pretty ramped up at that point. So I think I know what happened, that was a guy whose name is John Crawford, who still lives in Peterborough. And he had some objectivity like you did with that kid's parents where he could tell my father, I don't think you get what's going on here. But that was really it. No one ever said it to me directly.
When did you start composing?
Very late.
So you're because the reason why I was bad at practicing was because I just would naturally just say, instead of practicing, I might as well just write something, you know? And the mindset of somebody who's playing the greatest compositions in history with whatever classical background you have, and jazz. I mean, at least when you're improvising jazz, you're writing. You know, you don't realize you're writing. At least the improv part is supposedly never been heard before. An emotion.
Oscar Peterson would say that writing and improvisation are the same thing. It's just writing is improvisation slowed down.
But
then you have the luxury of making choices too.
Yeah. When did you start composing? Were you doing that in college at all?
I started, a little bit in college, but I was really such a sort of a monkey, like just because I play a bunch of different instruments, and I just was so excited to be around other musicians that wanted to play cool music. So I was just playing in every musical situation that I could have access to. And had never really thought about songwriting. And didn't really start songwriting until I was here in Los Angeles. And I wound up doing a lot of song demos for great older songwriters who didn't really play instruments.
So, you know, as a producer, somebody taught you how to record music too. So, I mean, sort of a jack of...
Not really.
No? I mean, like, when do you start recording demos?
I bought a Fostex 4-track cassette machine, which I still have. 3 of the tracks work. And, you know, I knew, okay, I need to buy a mic and a drum machine.
Don't you kind of wonder who taught you that, though? I mean, the assumption is that you were just like, no, I'm going to just figure this out. And you just kind of go to a music store or maybe you read on it, but it's not like you're surfing Google at that point. You're just figuring out, oh yeah, I'm going to get this recorder. I mean, where do you think the idea of recording, not only do you study how to play instruments, but then to study how you record instruments is a whole other technique.
And it didn't come naturally to me at all. And it took me years to get even passably good at it.
Yeah.
It was like I was having so much fun the first several years of doing it, but the results were often just really inconsistent, and I just didn't know what I was doing. I had no one show me anything. I didn't know what compression was. I could see the EQ on the Fostex 4-track, and that taught me how to use EQ in a rudimentary way. And I had a little Alesis Microverb. It was the only reverb I could afford at the time, and an AKG live microphone. That was my vocal mic for years. You know, even when I was here in LA cutting song demos. But it was cutting song demos in LA that really taught me almost everything.
Well, you graduate from
Humber,
which is where?
Toronto.
And then you go from, at that point, you know, you start realizing, oh yeah, I can do this. I want to be a musician. That's when you moved to LA?
Being at Humber, at the time, it was a 3-year program, and I did 2 years. And in the middle of that second year, I had a lunch with a really cool woman who unfortunately passed away a couple years ago. She was also from my hometown. She was at Humber as a jazz saxophonist, Kira Payne. And we were having lunch, and she said, "Have you ever heard of this thing called the Canada Council?" I'm like, "Nope." She said, it's a thing that was started by Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau, who was the Prime Minister of Canada for most of the 70s and a bit of the 80s. He was an intellectual who was a huge fan of the arts. And he started this government-funded thing where all kinds, anything artistic, you can apply for funding. Most people don't get it. You have to apply. It's a really exhaustive application, and it's reviewed by a whole like jury of adjudicators. And she said, "You might be able to, you know, why don't you come up with an idea? Like, I want to go study in Los Angeles for a year. Why don't you try that?"
Sure.
So I couldn't get that out of my head. And I found the phone number in Ottawa, which is like the capital of Canada. And that's where the Canada Council office is. And they mailed me an application, and I did a demo tape. I had to compose 4 songs. I hadn't really done that before. They were instrumental jazz songs, mostly jazz-ish. Found a demo studio of our teacher at Humber, Mike Farquharson. He had a studio in his basement. I went there and just recorded them. I'd never done that before, and sent it off with some letters of recommendation, said I wanted to come here and study with Claire Fisher and Terry Trotter. And Claire, actually, who also passed away several years ago, lived really close to here. So I would come here all the time to this neighborhood and take piano lessons with him. Claire Fisher was a famous jazz and classical musician who, among a million other things, did all of Prince's string arrangements. So anytime you hear strings on a Prince song, it's Claire. Yeah. And Prince never told Claire what to do. He would just send him the tapes from Minneapolis and say, "Do your thing." And Claire would do his thing and send him back. And that was their relationship for years. But Claire started recommending me for piano studio work for demos for songwriters.
First of all, it's fascinating how everyone has those turning points, but the fact that some people don't capitalize on those turning points, and that somebody can say, hey, you should study in LA. And you say, yeah, somehow that one stuck. So I'm going to go through this effort to do that. Because if I told you right now, you know what, you should go study in Stockholm, you'd be like, that sounds great, but I've got a family. I've got, you know, I'm not going to do that. But just that it's the right time with the right advice. If you take it, that could be the whole story can change like that, you know? So that's pretty amazing that you can pinpoint that moment, because that's a big moment. Did you end up playing on any, when you're starting to play piano on people's demos, did you play with anybody or on anything that kind of exploded on any sort of national stage? Or was it all kind of, you're playing on demos and people are shopping those demos for deals? Or what were these demos for?
The first session was a great singer and songwriter named David Lasley, who had some hits with Anita Baker at some point in, I guess, the 80s or early 90s. David has sung with James Taylor for decades. David and Arnold McCullough have been James's background singers forever. And David was this lovely, eccentric man who was just fantastic to work with. And I don't remember any of the songs that we played. It was so long ago. You know, it was like 1990 when I moved here. But then he called me again and I went back, and then I met some of his friends and I wound up working for them. And I'm pretty sure some of those songs wound up, you know, being placed. And then after a few years of doing that, I got recommended to producer-songwriter Rick Knowles. And lots of stuff that I did with Rick wound up, you know, being on the radio and having a life. And watching Rick in particular was really informative, you know, just in every way, because Rick is really a very talented songwriter.
Yeah.
But he also, you know, does a lot of record production, and he's just, he would always refer to the music we were working on as the record. He's like, play the record from the beginning. And I'm thinking, there is no, like, what do you mean? We just have, it's like a guitar and a scratch vocal. But he was, I love that he was always, at first I thought it was funny, but then I got it. Like, he's building a record. It's the record.
We'll bring Rick back up later. As a fellow musician in the community that really pushed for legislation and who helped get involved for the Music Modernization Act, shout out to Rick, our friend in common.
Yep, he sure did.
He did a lot of great work for the music community, so good on him. When do you, what's the story from all the way from 1990 to, you know, when we start learning about who Greg Wells is?
Oh, man. Just, again, you know, this was like pre-internet, like we were talking about before the show, pre-cell phone. And I had no connections. I didn't know anybody. I'd never been to California. My family had never traveled here. We didn't know anybody at all. So I was really, other than Claire Fisher and Terry Trotter, the two lovely people I was studying piano with, I hadn't met anybody here other than my neighbors at my apartment in Van Nuys, you know, on Magnolia Boulevard.
Not too far from here.
You know what it was? It was, do you remember The Recycler?
Yeah, sure.
So before Craigslist...
Yeah, explain what The Recycler is.
There was like I think it was free, classified paper, newspaper, would come out every week. And it was
just... be in front of like coffee shops, and it'd be in front of... it'd be at all the music stores.
Anywhere there was a newspaper stand.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was all over the place. And they were selling, you know, cars and whatever, but there was a huge, as you would imagine, in LA, there's a lot of musicians, and there's a lot of musicians that need to sell some gear to help pay the rent that month. And I remain one of those musicians. And there were great deals. Like, I remember getting an Electro Harmonix micro synth pedal, which is this really sort of holy grail geeked out cool guitar pedal, for $75. And the guy brought it to my apartment to try out.
Sure.
It was a different world. So there was a little line mixer. I had some keyboards at that point. I wanted to plug it into this Rain line mixer. This is not very songwritery talk, but it all kind of, it's all the same brushstroke. I saw there it was. There was the Rain line mixer I wanted to get. That was the right price. I think it was $300. And I called. And this really nice woman, Shelley, was on the other end of the phone call. And we got talking and having a nice conversation. And I said, well, would it be okay if I just tried it to make sure it works? She said, yeah, you can come by the office. It's fine. I'm thinking, what? You have a mixer in your office?
Yeah.
And I said, do you mind me asking, like, you said you had the mixers in your office. Are you in the music business? And I was so excited, like I could barely keep it together. And she said, yeah, I'm a songwriter for Almo Irving Publishing. And we have a writing room at their facility on La Brea. Come by there. So I was super excited. And, you know, it's the Charlie Chaplin lot that is now Henson Studios. It was A&M at the time, all Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. That was also Almo Irving. And she was great. And I bought the mixer and we just stayed in touch. And then she started hiring me to come play on some of her song demos. I don't think I'm answering your question.
No, you're totally answering it. I'm enthralled. She says she starts bringing you in on songs. And I mean, this is a big difference. That first time you go from I'm in LA or any city where you're pursuing music, that difference of I want to be versus doing is everything. Right. So somewhere in that is, you know, when somebody in the business reaches down and says, come on in.
Yeah.
You know, you have this, that's another one of those turning points just by keeping in touch with that person.
I can trace almost everything in my career back to that, buying that line mixer from Shelly Speck.
Crazy.
Who's now a lawyer.
Do you still keep in touch with her?
Yeah, I do. Every couple of years I'll send her an email.
Yeah. What's the first significant cut, in your opinion, for your career where you go from, where you have that moment of...
As a what?
As a writer or producer.
Well, I didn't start producing anything till the very late 90s.
So let's go with as a writer.
My songwriting career began with a real sort of like, you know, Christopher Nolan, like Interstellar, just like bam, oh my goodness, like literally from nothing to Aerosmith was my first cut. And I had, through playing on a lot of these song demos, as a musician, you know, that's the my musician toolbox and whatever it is I do as a musician or don't do is something that has received a lot of attention all my life. You know, I've been doing it since I was a little boy. I guess the song demo sounded good enough for someone to ask, like, well, who's doing the track on that? And then I met Barbara Vanderlind, who was a publisher at Almo Irving. I did not meet her through Shelly Speck, who was signed to Almo Irving, but I met Barbara, I think, through songwriter Mark Muller. And this would have been like 95, maybe? Right at sort of at the end of when I was working with Rick Knowles. And Barbara said, okay, well, I get that you know, are you interested in being a songwriter? The answer was yes. And she said, well, I'm going to give you an assignment. I want you to do three different tracks. I want you to do one that's kind of like Jagged Little Pill, like Alanis Morissette sort of vibe. I want you to do something else, something like Annie Lennox's solo record. Just do a few different things. Show me what you can do with tracks. So I did. And one of the tracks was actually me just getting a guitar sound on this little Zoom unit that I had, you know, simulating guitar amps. And I was just playing a thing, just trying to get a sound. And then I realized the thing I'm playing was actually better than the song idea I thought I was going to do. I wound up doing that other song idea. But then I thought, I'm going to build a track around this thing that just appeared. So I did. And I think it was like 6 minutes long. You know, I had no clue about song form. Really, like just total indulgent muso, not thinking about song structure at all. And I gave that to Barbara. I didn't hear anything for a few weeks. And she said, one of these things I really like. And she played it over the phone. I said, oh God, that was just an accident. She's like, well, it's my favorite one. I'm going to send it to a friend of mine. So a couple of weeks later, I found out that Mark Hudson, Sarah's father, was best friends with Steven Tyler of Aerosmith. Mark got that track probably on a cassette tape that was 6 minutes long. It could have been 13 minutes long. I don't remember, but it was way too long. And he chopped it up, put it into song form, edited the crap out of it, just my stereo two-track demo mix, and started writing what we would now call a top line over it. No one used that term then. And he was working on it, and he swears this is what happened. As he was working on it, Steven Tyler called him on the phone and heard the music playing in the background and said, what's that? And then it became an Aerosmith song. And Mark had to videotape me playing the guitar part to send to Joe Perry, because Joe, who's a great guitar player, couldn't quite get his head around how I was playing, because I sort of play guitar like a piano player. I have a weird way of doing it. I'm just self-taught. And there was one thing that was tripping him up, and I'm like, had to, you know,
send that
to Joe Perry. And when I got the rough
to
mix.
To Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Joe Perry, you're like, hey.
It's totally absurd. Right, you know, absurd. Yeah. And all my self-hatred and self-doubt was just like on 10, you know, go, what? This is all wrong. It's wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. But they did it, and it was produced by Glenn Ballard. And I heard the rough mix of that, and it sounded fantastic. And then Glenn got fired from the project, and they redid the whole record. And I thought, well, my song's not going to make it, but it did. And a guy named Kevin Shirley from Australia, he came in and produced kind of a rawer, more rocky version of Aerosmith. And the label liked that better. They felt like Glenn's thing was not didn't quite sound like Aerosmith. I thought it sounded great. And they were trying to like do a new
thing. But even just, you know, at this point you're like legend Rick Knowles, legend like Glenn Ballard, legend. These are like the greatest.
The first time Glenn called me, some of the best writers
and producers of a generation. And you're just happening to be like, you know. It's just crazy because, I mean, it's easy in retrospect to say that because in the time you're just, I'm just hustling.
No. When Glenn called me, I almost lost bowel control, you know. And I remember saying to him within the first minute, like, I can't believe I'm speaking to the person that wrote Man in the Mirror.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sitting in my little rent control apartment and just like, what's going on, you know? And Glenn was awesome. Glenn continues to be super friendly with me and supportive. And he, you know, that felt like a big hand reaching down moment.
When that came out, because it's one thing when you start getting cuts, it's another thing when you start getting Aerosmith cuts. You know, when especially at that point, because that's, I mean, that was a huge record.
So my next cut, again because of Barbara Vanderlyn, was with Celine Dion.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that was
and
a song.
In their prime, too. It's not, I mean, not to say that they're not always in there. These are legends. They can put out music whenever they want. But this really is like both of their sweet spots.
Yeah, people were, you couldn't steal music yet. Or if you could, most people didn't quite know how to do it yet. No, you couldn't steal music at that point.
I mean, the best thing you can do is copy a tape and then you have to send the tape to somebody. Then they have to copy it one-on-one and it takes too long and it loses fidelity and it's crap.
Right.
But I mean, the Celine Dion one, that's crazy. And what year is that?
Well, it's all Mark Hudson. It's all his fault. So that's how we met, was through that ridiculously indulgent cassette tape that, thank God, he turned into a song.
Yeah.
And then he started asking me to come work with him. And he taught me so much. And we were at that songwriting event in France at Miles Copeland's castle when I was not running it. I mean, I was a baby, and everyone else there was far more established and usually much older than me. And I remember it was the first day of the second time I went to it. And Miles came up to Mark and said, who would you like to write with tomorrow? And Carole King was there. And we were all just kind of talking. Mark just pointed to me and Carole. I said, these two. And I was like, again, bowel control became an issue. And I was just like, what is happening? You know, so the next day we were sitting in a room and I'd never met Carole before. And I'd worked with Mark probably for about a year at this point. And he said, okay, so I'm very involved in Aerosmith's new record and they need a power ballad. I think we're the team to write it. And we were all just like, okay, that's great. So to be fair, I really watched Carole and Mark write this song. Like, I was 25 years old, I think, maybe 26, 25, 26. And every 10 or 15 minutes, I would sort of chime in and go, are you sure you should say fuck there? You know, I don't know if you can say that on the podcast, but are you sure you should curse? Like, should it be, you know, or like, what about that one chord you played 5 minutes ago instead of, I would just sort of interject as a very shy, very, you know, unproven, quiet, anemic looking kid in the corner of the room, watching these two veterans, you know, who have really strong pitching arms, just like throw these 100-mile-an-hour speed balls. And we wrote a song called The Reason that was for Aerosmith. And Steven Tyler loved it. The rest of the band didn't connect with it. And the song just sort of was dying on the vine. And we played it for everybody and everyone passed on it. And again, Barbara Vanderlyn, kick-ass Barbara Vanderlyn, played it for engineer Umberto Gatica, who was David Foster's engineer for years. They had a meeting and she just thought, I'm going to play this for him just to see. And he flipped out and he said, you know who should sing this? Celine Dion should sing this. And it's kind of like a rocky.
Who sang the demo?
Carol did. Yeah. Carol. I think that's part of the reason Aerosmith had trouble with embracing the song, because I remember at some point I heard from someone in the band said something to the effect that we can't sing a Carole King song. We're Aerosmith. And it clearly was designed for
that's
them.
That's so interesting. I mean, considering that they've cut Diane Warren songs.
That was later.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and that's their biggest song, actually.
Right.
So, you know, these are all nice problems. And I remember Barbara called me and she said, Umberto Gatica is going to go play this for Celine. And I said, Celine's never going to sing this song. There's a line in it. It was very Steven Tyler. In the middle of the night, I'm going down because I adore you. I want to floor you. Yeah. Like, Celine's not going to sing that lyric. She did, you know, and it was the same album that had the Titanic theme on it. It's her biggest album.
And she's, I mean, people don't, if they've never been around her recording, they don't realize that she's funny, she's strong, she's, you know, she's a badass. She's not just this person who sings songs. She's the person who runs the session in all the positive ways, and everyone around her loves being around her. She's maybe the best reputation of any of the, quote, divas. You know, she just has this ability to make everybody love her, and she is no joke. I mean, she is a strong human, and if she wants to cut that song and that lyric, she's cutting that song
right.
and that lyric. And you know, that's really cool. I mean, that's a crazy album. I mean, to be on
it was
probably
nuts.
20 million albums worldwide.
It was way over 30.
Yeah, that's
it was
insane.
Crazy.
And that, you know, for you at that point, that goes from, I imagine, you know, it's hard to explain not to jump forward to mechanical royalties and stuff. But at 9.1 cents per song, that's, you know, and 30 million albums sold, that's, a you know, $910,000 in mechanical royalties alone per songwriter, you know, versus now a hit song, you know, on mechanical royalties, you're splitting $30,000 on streaming. You know, it's not even in the same ballpark. But I imagine when you have that, and just following, look, the Aerosmith still probably sold 5-10 million albums worldwide. You know, you probably ended up having enough at that point to be, you know, to have a nicer apartment.
So, like I said a while back, my songwriting career began with a real start, you know?
Yeah.
And then it was years of total inactivity.
Yeah.
I could not get arrested. I couldn't, like, I had no cuts. I kept trying. I was writing all the time. I wound up signing with Barbara Vanderlyn at Rondor. Became Alma Irving. I think I'm correct about that. They changed their name to Rondor. And I was with her for 4 years, and I learned tons and met some incredible songwriters. And Barbara was hugely supportive. And I'm sure it's all my fault, but it took me a long time to realize that really, really good is just not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. I was so excited to get to work with, you know, people with careers that were talented, that knew a lot more than me. And because I don't like being the best player on the team. I like the opposite.
Yeah.
And, but I think I had not developed kind of a strong enough focus on how good a song has to be just to sort of show up on people's radar.
There's a book I've been reading. It's literally next to my bed right now that I'm reading right now, called Good to Great. And it's about it's a 15-year-old business book, but it's something that songwriters and any entrepreneur can use. But essentially it discusses the great companies, how they go. You think of Chrysler with Lee Iacocca as a great company, but in reality, it actually it spiked and then it dropped, and it was all ego, and it was not necessarily these companies who progressively build over time and can max out the market. All this stuff that seems not relatable to what we're talking about, except for the fact that the through line, you know, behind the companies that are like economically great are ones where the bar is set at a certain level, and in the company, the culture is about doing your very best and doing it for the team. And like you said, not be the smartest person in the room. Try to hire people who are really great and let them do their thing. And it's all about, you know, the idea of building something great is such a different thing. And as a songwriter, people are, we're flooded with good. There's so much good. Any professional songwriter writes a good song every day, you know? But to do something great that can get in that top 40, when those songs don't switch every week, it's not 40 songs per week. It's like, you know, 200 songs a year get in the top 40. I don't know what the stat is, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's right or if it's less, you know?
And
it's
most people,
so few songs.
Most people don't like most of those songs.
Yeah, true. And even that, where we listen, and we even listen to those as listeners, and we criticize those. We're like, this song sucks, this song sucks, this song sucks. To be in that top five or the top one.
And I have to remind myself that, like, for every one of those songs that we criticize, there's probably 10,000 other versions of that song that aren't as good as the one we're criticizing, that weren't just, they weren't good enough or whatever was missing to make it, to occupy that slot.
Does it give you empathy for other songwriters?
It's the hardest thing. People think that our careers as songwriters, it's like we're just like, we've won the lottery. No, until you try and write a great song, no one understands how utterly masochistic and almost impossible it is to write a great song.
Sure.
The guy that owns Blackbird Studios in Nashville, John McBride, he loves to say, good is the enemy of great.
Yeah.
Which I that's don't right. think is originally his quote.
No, someone it's, from, else it's from that book.
It's from the book,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's course, the first chapter. Good is the enemy of great.
Good is the enemy of great.
That's right.
You know, and I think to really feel that in your bones, you have to jump into the cold deep end of that pool and try to write a song and empathy is everything. Empathy is enormously helpful to me in the studio. I think empathy is the thing that separates the brilliant businesses today from the non-brilliant ones. You know, empathy for your customer, for what, like trying to, when I was making Greatest Showman, I didn't make the movie. When I was helping make the music, producing and mixing the music for that thing, I kept trying to play with linear time and imagine that I'd bought a ticket, that I was sitting in the theater, in the audience, watching the finished film, because I got to work the picture with that thing. And thinking, okay, what do I want to feel? What do I wish? Because I'm always analyzing in real time when I'm listening to a record or watching a movie. Like, well, they could have, why didn't they do that? Or that was great, or, you know, trying to be an audience member.
Yeah.
I think that's how Rick Rubin produces records.
If you start writing with respect for the listener and to understand that that person's an expert at listening to music and not try to dumb down your music to feel like the person who's listening to my music is probably stupid, that's the first way your song's not going to work. But if you go and you actually respect your listener and you start giving them an experience where they're actually entertained, then I think you have a shot. There's got to be some sort of understanding of how someone listens to music to know how you write it. So,
with LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
But let's go back to some of the story. You know, like you said, you had trouble sort of, you go from Celine Dion, then you have this kind of lull. You have some songs that come out, but it's really, you know, I feel like the first like big single to be associated with was Apologize. Is that right? Or am I missing something before that?
You know, I produced Jesse McCartney's Beautiful Soul.
Okay.
And that was the number one song around the world. I think that was my first number one as a young producer. That was like early 2000s.
Okay.
And I mixed that one as well.
Do you care whether you write it or not?
No. No. The only thing I care about is if I really, really, really click with the music.
Right.
That's it. I don't really rate myself as a songwriter. I mean, I love doing it with the right people and on the right thing. And like, for instance, when you and I have written together, it's like, that's as good as it gets for me. Especially the first time we wrote, and then we got Small World out of that. That's one of the best songs I've ever been a part of. You know, your vocal on the demo of that is just one of the most moving. I cry every time I hear it. You know, if it was always like that, I'd quit being a record producer and I'd songwrite every day. But I'm a multi-headed beast, very ugly beast. and so when I'm not producing,
except for when you're dancing naked around the room,
then it's there's no words for that. I've lost the plot. What was that?
Well, we were talking about the not, you know, being a producer and not writing. You know, that there, I find that right now in an era where the idea of producers are automatically songwriters but songwriters aren't automatically producers, but now it's sort of like songwriters are becoming producers, and it's a little confusing as to what everyone does, except for those, you know, I know Ian does it sometimes, Ian Kirkpatrick has been on this, and Johan Carlson, and there are a lot of people who are, you know, and you are relevant producers who are willing to produce records that they didn't write on. Just because you love the music, it seems like an anomaly now.
I think it's such a missed opportunity to not be open to that. I mean, some of my favorite movie directors did not write the movie.
Right. Oh,
and we're like, of course that's true. Yeah. Well, hello. A record producer is like a movie director. I think it should be called the record director. I think that makes more sense.
I love that.
Because it's directing a movie. There's no visual, but you know, the buck stops with the record producer. And in movies, there was a delineation at some point between the movie producer, who is more raising than taking care of the finances, and the movie director. And, you know, in the collective public awareness, we're all kind of aware of what a movie director does. We kind of get it. Nobody knows what a record producer does, because with people like Phil Spector or George Martin, where the producer, who was more the business person overseeing things, making sure the train didn't go off the tracks, became more of a creative member of the record-making process. And I wish that the term director had kind of crept in like it did with movies. I think with movies, it was probably always there. But a lot of the records that I've got my music on, I did write with the artist or whoever was in the room. A lot I didn't. And, you know, Apologize is a song that I fought really hard for the band to record. The band didn't want to do it. I didn't write that. Ryan Tedder wrote it. And I'm not thinking, well, I'm not going to produce Apologize because I didn't write it.
Right.
Like that is just, for me, that just doesn't work. You know, right. And the other thing too is there's all kinds of different records being made. Like there's more entertainment type records where you have a singer who actually is not a writer and has no point of view, but looks great. And, you know, there's a young kid who just got signed to Capitol based on an app she was using where she was lip syncing.
Yeah.
And she got a massive record deal. Yeah. She's the hottest thing right now. And she got a record deal not even based on her singing. It was just like she's lip syncing to someone else singing. So there's that kind of world, right? Where, you know, both you and I get called to work with that kind of artist. But then there's like, you know, a band like Family of the Year who's just writing like beautiful songs, and I produced their new record and I didn't write with them at all. And I love what they do. It's sort of like a lot of my favorite stuff, like Elliott Smith meets Death Cab for Cutie. It was just like beautiful, amazing songs. And then there's, you know, well, I don't need to categorize every record that's being made, but there's lots of different, there's tons of bands that have huge careers that are never played on the radio. There's tons of acts that are played on the radio that can't sell tickets to,
I just think it's strange when people look at, you know, I like the movie analogy, and I've said the thing similarly where, you know, no one expects Meryl Streep to be the screenwriter, you know.
And
it's okay. She's not asking for screenwriting credit.
Thank you for that.
She's not asking for a percentage of it. You know, it's not like
Her goons are not calling up,
right? And you know, never have
Rupert Murdoch and going, no, she needs, you know, script like story yeah. doctor credit. And I mean, it's
so yeah. And you have it's same thing where my friends, a lot of my friends are in production for film and TV because, well, we live in LA and that's what people do. And they give story notes all the time. It's all about story notes to the screenwriter. They're not getting any co-writing. Just because they go and, you know, every time I give a note to one of my writers, if I went and started taking publishing, I would be, I would be some of the previous producers who did that. And I don't want to do that. You know, I think that that's not the spirit of what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, if everyone is, you know, what I like is that you keep giving credit where credit's due. And that takes a lot of, there's a humility that comes with being able to say, I didn't do the following things. They did this. But what I did was this. And to be very clear about everybody's contribution to a song, to make it, you know, in the theater world and in the film world, it's so clear
yep.
what everyone does.
And it's a more professional, you know, environment. I mean, yeah. I'm sure people in the film and TV world might laugh when they hear me say that, but
I have a show that's opening in New York, right? And we were going over the contracts, and the contracts in theater are 100 years old with legal precedent, older than what we deal with. Most of our contracts are from essentially 1945 on, you know, like big band era. Then you get into like really the 50s and you get Elvis, and it starts to move towards actually moving units where we have to have protection against shellac records breaking in transport. So most of our contracts and our legal precedent is 60 years old. But there's been professional theater in the United States since, you know, I mean, Lincoln was shot at a professional show. So they had contracts at that time with the theater, the cast, the actors, the costume designers, all that stuff. So there's 100 more years of legal precedent in that world. You know, moving pictures is only 100 years old, you know, for a commercial yeah. ability. So you're talking about these are really young businesses, and it's easy for us to think, well, that's just the way it is. But, you know, 60 years ago, that's what we're talking about for the record business. 100 years ago is what we're talking about for publishing. 40 years longer than recording, really. I mean, there's recording, but as far as mass marketing, where they're selling, you know, bobbleheads and lunchboxes, you know, it's 40 years older. But it's just interesting. I think the way we define our business is still really young, and we're still trying to figure out how to define it. And, you know, on some level, as much as I hate when I use the word, like, I'm a top liner. It's like, I'm a songwriter. I play instruments. I write melodies. I write lyrics. I'm a songwriter. But the delineation of saying I'm a top liner makes it very clear for when people are putting sessions together. Yeah. And I kind of respect that. As I've gotten older, as much as I get annoyed with the limitations of that, I think there's some clarity with, oh, this guy primarily does lyrics and melodies. Mm-hmm. So let's not put six of those top liners in a room. You know, if you put three songwriters in a room, you might get the three top liners and nothing right, gets done, right. You know. But you end up with, you know, you produce Apologize, and really over those next few years, you Apologize, especially the, you know, the remix of it, and then having, you know, 3 years later being a part of the Adele album and Teenage Dream for Katy Perry, it kind of is just a trifecta in a matter of 3 years of sort of three of the biggest kind of projects you could be a part of. Does that change as a jazz, as somebody who's sort of trained as a jazz, as you said, jazz-ish musician at times, you know, classical, you're a producer. How does it change when all of a sudden you're kind of, now you're like for real a pop producer? Like, I don't think people must have been coming to you for those, you know, that young artist signed on Capitol. All of a sudden, all the pop projects must have come to you. You know, it must have changed how people view you, whether or not you change as a person. I mean, I can imagine if you're selling, in an era where people aren't selling albums, and you look at those three and you're still like, well, that's 25 million, that's another 10 million, and that's another 10 million. You know, it's like you're still selling all these albums, but they're super, like, and they're the definition of,
well, I think,
you know, popular music.
I mean, I know I can't fully speak for Katy, but I know that Katy Perry, when we met, was really into the fact that I had produced Rufus Wainwright.
Mm-hmm.
And Katy really came for more of that Hotel Cafe, Ingrid Michaelson, Josh Radin, like, singer-songwriter thing, and that's what she was doing when we met. She actually was doing some more than that, but it was more rooted in that kind of, just, you know, she'd go on stage with an acoustic guitar and play a gig, just her, which she can still very much do. I think she still has a moment in her set where she does that. So I was definitely an outsider. I wasn't just viewed as an outsider in the pop world. I really was one. I'd worked with, like, Rufus Wainwright and the Deftones, you know, or OTEP, like a female-fronted death metal band. Those are the records that I was very proudly making. And I remember Cara DioGuardi calling me going, can you come? There's this new girl, Ashley Simpson. And I'd be like, sorry, I'm on a 7-month OTEP record. I can't do it, you know? And I'm really happy that Cara met John Shanks and that they wound up doing a lot of that work that Cara, I think, was initially speaking to me about,
which
I couldn't do because I was, you know, stuck on producing long records that I'm still, to this day, super proud of and still friends with those artists. But it wasn't until that. So I met a bunch of people in 2005. I met Katy. I met Ryan Tedder. I met a guy named Marshall Altman.
Yeah.
Who Marshall, I think, is the reason that I met Ryan and Katy. I had dinner with him about a year ago in Nashville. He was a big door opener for me. He put me into the office of Tim Devine, who used to run West Coast Columbia. And Tim put me in the room with those people. I'm very thankful to Marshall. And I remind him all the time when I see him, like, that really was a career changer. But I was so sort of in the eye of whatever my little tiny hurricane was that I, like, hearing you talk about it that way, I've never ever thought about it that way before. I really haven't.
It's also weird when you're in all of us. It's now is very slow. It's really easy for me to say in those 3 years and call out essentially four songs that can define those 3 years in a lot of ways in a really positive way. But when you're in it and you're waiting 6 months for this song to come out and you're on mix number 17 and it looks like it's going to not make the album, now sucks. But it's really easy to look back and be like, oh yeah, I sold 25 million albums in 3 years on these projects that I chose. You know what? I'm gonna produce this one because who would not produce Apologize? And here's Adele who had Chasing Pavements, but really nothing after that. You know, this was the first album after Chasing Pavements as a single. And then it goes from being like, oh yeah, I'll work on that, to it selling 25 million and being number one on the charts for 18 months or something like that. And then, you know, Teenage Dream sets the record for most number one singles by a female. And you're writing with this person when they're an acoustic guitarist, and you're dealing with, like, here's a singer-songwriter and being close with the artist because that was your path. But the idea of, it's easy for me to say, oh, in those 3 years, you also did that, because we only have an hour to talk about a whole career.
Right, right, right.
But when you're going through those 3 years, it's working with an acoustic person who's signed a major, who's on, you know, whatever version of however many times she's sent in demos for them not to and hear it, and they released stuff and it didn't work. And
I got to point,
you know,
out.
Apologize, God. Sorry, real quick, but like One Republic gets dropped. And then they, you know what?
Katy got dropped too.
Yeah, like all these people are getting dropped. It's not like, it's easy now to say Katy Perry, Ryan Tedder, and Adele. But at the time, you're talking about somebody who had a moderate hit in the U.S. with Chasing Pavements, a band who just got dropped, and an artist who just got dropped.
Yeah, Katy, that was Katy's third time she got dropped.
Crazy.
Third time she got. I had people in the industry saying, why do you continue to work with Katy Perry, who was 24 years old at the time? She's old news.
Yeah.
This is before One of the Boys came out. She's old news. What do you do? Like, clearly she's trouble. She's been dropped three times. You're wasting your time. I was told to quit Mika's first album because he was too weird. And, you know, I was told by the team that took care of me at the time, like, maybe do two songs and then get out.
Yeah.
I mean, but I wanted to say while you were saying, like, we're looking back in hindsight going, well, there's that and that. I really do want to point out, and, you know, it'll be obvious to us in the room here, but most of what I did then and most of what I continue to do now never sees the light of day.
Why?
All kinds of reasons. Most of what I do doesn't turn into a hit. Most of what I do doesn't even get finished because people are distracted and not everyone's got the wherewithal and the skill set to see something through to the end and have it show up in the marketplace. And then once that happens, then things are really out of your control. Like who else released a record that week? And is the promo person at the record company going to chase the hardest, most, you know, like the thing that they love, but doesn't sound like anything on the radio right now? Or are they going to chase things that sound like 10 other things on the radio so they can collect their bonus check, which comprises half of their annual salary? Right. What do you think they're going to do? So, you know, I can get really kind of cynical about this stuff, but it's just reality. It's like, that's the kind of stuff we're up against. So that's why most of what I do and can continue to do doesn't have a life, you know, but I've worked just as hard on that stuff as I did on convincing One Republic to let me produce Apologize for them.
Well, and you were able to work on, you know, I know a lot of us had met with Dua Lipa and had worked with her, you know, and she was working with Jeff Fenster at Warner, and a lot of us, you know, spent some time with her. But an alto singer who's singing pop music, not really the most popular kind of female singer, beautiful, smart, cool, all those things. But I don't know if you think, at the time, you know, before somebody's a hit, signed to a label that was really struggling, I don't know if you think, okay, this is going to become the biggest pop star of 2018 either. You know, I mean, it's another thing where you just hustle and you kind of are like, well, who would have thought? Like, I'm really happy for her. She's a really cool person. And that's a nice surprise. But,
totally.
You know, you just don't expect it. The one thing that I think you can expect was The Greatest Showman. I don't think you can expect it to be as big as it was. But Michael Gracie, the director, came into studios and essentially acted out the entire movie, scene by scene, passionately telling his story of what the movie was going to become. And if you were honored to be in the room with him during the introduction of what this soundtrack and what this movie meant to him, you'd be crazy to not spend time on it. And then to have Pasek and Paul, who had done Dear Evan Hansen, and, you know, obviously they did La La Land, but then for you to be able to work so closely with them on this project, that, unlike these other ones, seemed like, well, if I have this opportunity, let's just not screw this up, you know? Or maybe I'm biased because I saw the process of it and was so enamored with those people, you know? But that seemed like the opportunity, you know, of one of those opportunities that in the end of your career, you're going to look back and say, yeah, I'm so happy was in the room for Michael, you know?
You're right. The meeting with Michael was so, he is just so incredibly infectious and kind of winning in his passion. And he's also a badass. Like, do you ever remember? What an
period.
Awkward.
No.
That Evian commercial where babies are in roller skates.
No.
And they're dancing and there's a disco ball and it really looks like babies are in roller skates dancing.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, okay.
That's one of Michael's early commercials.
Oh, where?
And it really looks, and this was a long time ago, but it was just, no one could believe what we were seeing. You know, he's a visual genius.
Yeah.
He's a genius at a bunch of stuff, but I knew that about him, and I knew that he'd done that Evian commercial, which blew me away when I saw it, and I was really honored that he wanted to take a meeting, you know, about a movie he was making. He never directed a movie before. And you're right, the meeting was just so incredible, and it was contagious, the way he felt for the story and the movie. And I was like, I'm in. You know, I'm in. Of course I'm in. I never heard from them for another 10 months, and we just thought it had gone away. And it turns out that they had been told, Pasek and Paul and Michael had been told that Greg Wells passed. He wasn't interested. And it was the opposite. I'm like, I'm dying to do, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I don't know why they were told that, but they all swear up and down they were told that a few times. And finally, we just got through to them and like, Greg really loved that meeting. Like, can we please And they're like, well, we wanted Greg to, but anyway, so then we finally figured out the cloud passed and we started working on it. We did not expect it to be a hit. We were trying to make a classic movie, a modern musical classic. I thought maybe the movie has a shot at finding an audience. And I remember saying to my manager at the time, who asked me what points should we ask for in the soundtrack, because I had to share with other producers that had been hired and then let go throughout the process of making the movie. What should we ask for? And I said, Andy, it doesn't matter what we ask for, because no one's going to buy the soundtrack to from a family movie about a circus. It's just this soundtrack is great and I'm really proud of it. And I busted my butt on it for over half a year, but I don't think it's going to get noticed. It's the biggest album of 2018.
Yeah.
Not just in this country, but around the world.
Yeah.
Like dwarfing sales by anybody else. And I honestly was like, I think it's going to flop.
It's cool to see that, you know, to see that as being as big of a success as it was, and to continue with sort of the Alex Lacamoire train, to have Hamilton also be super successful, you know, for that to be so successful shows still that there are people willing to listen to stories, and they're willing to listen to albums that are made to be albums. And if you give people singles, they'll listen to singles. You give them a compilation of singles, they'll listen to the singles they want to hear. If you give them a story, they might just listen from front to finish in the way that albums are supposed to be made.
As content.
Not just a collection of records, but as a concept. I know it's a soundtrack, but
it's a story.
It's a story.
Everything we do is storytelling.
Yeah.
And they just had the commitment and the cojones to go, we're going to tell this story over the course of a two-hour, $100 million movie, and we're going to spend 4 years writing the music and, you know, dive off the cliff at this. Like, what is it? Is it our frontal lobe? Like, why do we need to know stories? Why are we such suckers for great stories? But we need to understand what our own story is,
sure.
Why we're here, what does this all mean? You know, we're just, I don't think wolves are walking around the forest asking the same questions, or, you know, worms or sharks, but we, for whatever reason, we have this more narcissistic gene gumbo, and we will always be suckers for a great story. So, you know, the music business, I could be wrong with this, but I feel like they hate The Greatest Showman soundtrack because it's not cool. It's not sexy. It hardly ever gets mentioned in the press. But
here, but in the UK, it's everything. No? It feels like that. Or maybe, you know, it's just the stats.
I just everything. Took a bunch of meetings in London a few months ago. And in every one of those meetings, no one knew I was the producer of that soundtrack. Mm. It would come up and they'd be like, oh. And the whole tone of the room would change. You know? Mm. It's not, because it's not a cool record. Which is also part of the reason I thought it wouldn't connect with the marketplace. I just thought this is such a unique, specific thing. And I've never worried about being cool. I think being cool is actually like going the opposite way, like just doing something that's so kind of, it just is what it is, you know? Like when I saw you perform your musical, whether it's like, it's just such strong content that it obliterates all those sort of insecure concerns of like, well, is this a fashionable, trendy thing that we can like turn into? None of that matters. Dear Evan Hansen's same kind of vibe for me when I see that. Just like the storytelling is just so incredible. It's
the
it's
book
so
of that.
Immersive.
That's the best book of a musical I've seen in so long. Of
it just Dear came Evan Hansen. Out, right?
No, not like the actual like story of it.
Oh,
you know,
oh, I see
the Stephen Levinson's story of that. It's like when you see a room full of, you know, 1,500 people crying, a unanimous, you know, group cry is the weirdest thing you can experience in a show. So, you know, real quick, I just want you to talk about, I know that you've been involved in trying to, you've taken over the camp in France at Miles Copeland's, you know, castle, and you've been involved in creating music schools in Los Angeles. And I just want you to talk a little bit about, you know, sort of what you see as the future of, you know, music in the world, and why you're putting so much effort into that. And, you know, also to, in the same sort of breath, thank you for helping get some of these major names on the Music Modernization Act stuff. I know we needed the help and you were there to help out, and that was super appreciated, because sometimes it felt like, you know, swimming alone in the ocean, it was nice, and there were other people there who were like, oh, here's a buoy.
Well, that's a funny thing about human nature.
You know,
human nature is such a quizzical thing, like, to watch you stick your neck out as far as you did and go up against these companies. When you see somebody doing that, then the instinct is to raise your hand and go, oh, I want to help with that. But it's so rare to find someone who will start that race and be the that goose in front of the long triangle of geese flying through the, you know.
Yeah.
It's tough. People don't get how scary that is, and lonely and lack of support and all of it. It's terrifying, you know, but you felt so compelled to take that stuff on, and well done, by the way, you know, and look what happened.
Crazy.
I mean, the results speak for themselves. It's incredible.
Step one. I mean, this will be a
big
really
step.
Huge, huge step, but it's about correcting that 60-year part of, you know, if we're talking about 1948 as a law to keep us from essentially unionizing and determining how we get paid for radio play, and if we're going to talk about a 1909 law for us, you know, that we just took head on with the MMA,
mm-hmm.
you know, these are not the oldest laws on the book somehow, but no one's going to tell me how I'm going to get paid in the year 2127, which is 109 years from now, and no one's going to tell my great-grandkids how they're going to get paid. It's our job to stand up for those people. Those, you know, will be long gone.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's just, some of this stuff is just not right. You know,
I think our nature is creative people, and I'm just speaking for myself. It's like, I'm inherently flaky with money. You know, I don't know what my bank balance is. I only know when I'm out of money. That's the one balance that I resonate with,
right.
When it's zero,
yeah.
You know,
right.
Which, by the way, just happened to me last week.
What?
It did.
Oh.
Like, it was almost zero, because the way that I get paid as a record producer is, and I had 8 projects that had not paid me over the last year. Some of it was over a year ago.
You were just waiting for...
So I'm not, you know, I'm like working on whatever I'm working on. I've got 5 children and my outgoing remains the same every month, and it's a big outgoing just to keep the plates spinning in the air. And 8 projects hadn't paid. And the same thing happened to me about 7 or 8 years ago. It was like 5 projects hadn't paid because someone hadn't signed a contract and people were on to the next. And these are records that have come out and like were on the radio or whatever, having a life. And my team caught it a little late and I didn't catch it because I don't pay attention to it. So I'm like, oh, my Amex is frozen right now because we don't have the money in the account to pay the massive Amex bill that I have to pay every month, you know. It's so anyway, I don't mind to distract with all that, but like, it's tough being a creative person in the weird, circuitous ways that we do get paid, because there's so many different income streams. It's not like you work for a company, you get one check every 2 weeks.
Right.
There's so many different paths that money shows up from, especially when you're a songwriter, and I'm also producing records, and you know, as a musician, I make royalties on neighboring rights in Europe and other countries in the world, and you got to keep track of that stuff. So we are sitting ducks. I am a sitting duck for people who want to rip me off. It wouldn't be that hard, you know? And I think that's why the music business has such a well-deserved bad rap, because people like us, although you seem to be more kind of clued into the business aspect of things, I don't have that neuron really firing in my brain. I wish I did. It's quite a feeble one if I have it. It's easy to stay focused on creative stuff and sort of like miss, oh, you know, whoops, I should have covered that, or I should have...
I think it's not that. It's the fact that when... I know that we're struggling having even music in schools in a basic sense, but entertainment is, in comparison to other countries, our best export. We're not even competing with other countries, really. So if we're not teaching... If our job in school is to teach how to survive the Industrial Revolution by doing math and science all the time, And we ignore the fact that entertainment is such a massive export for us. Why, when you're doing theater class, would you not teach that? And this is my sister's job at a high school in Chicago right now. She made this job partly because she lived here. Why aren't you teaching these kids? No, there's a whole world of, you know, of theater and film. And, you know, for music, while you're studying music school, why don't they say in your music class, in your jazz band, say, by the way, here's some things that you can do. I mean, I remember my jazz teacher in high school giving me Kind of Blue and saying, write lyrics to this if you're going to be the singer of this. So, oh, okay, I can do that. And like listening to the melody, you know, and writing top line. I didn't know what I was doing, but I'm sure Mr. Brame didn't know about top lining. But had he said, this is what you are now a top liner at 14, and I'm learning to write songs that I'm writing by myself at home anyway, to understand, oh, that's interesting. That's what my profession is going to be. You know, I mean, part of the music school should be the music industry. So that way, even if it doesn't, you don't have to sit there counting your checks or your bank account. You don't have to look, it's not that. It's just understanding the basics in what a point is and why you fight for that point. We had this situation, not to go on like a tangent, but you know, somebody wanted an extra whatever percentage of one of my writer's songs, and it's one of my writers, so I'm going to fight super hard to say, hell no. If it's me, I don't mind saying, well, we'll negotiate. But the answer is just no. You're not taking my writer's assets. It's how they get paid, you know? And if you're going to represent writers or artists, you have to be the front line of that war. And writers are just so easily stepped on because we need releases and all that stuff. But if you don't set the boundary, then they will march right through your line. They will just go in and they'll start taking more and they'll take more. And it's like, it's time for our industry to sort of advance our line forward. And that's sort of where I feel like we're moving, is to explain, like, this is what we're up against. We're up against billion-dollar companies who say they don't need us until we pull the rug out from under them. Say, okay, well, let's see you battle this letter that Paul McCartney and Katie and all these people are signing, you know? Let's go. Let's see what happens in the press here.
We are really smart yet really dumb animals. You know, we're easily fooled by very simple devices. Like people that smile all the time. To me at this point, that's like a red flag.
That's
me.
Really funny.
You know, that's a red flag. Like, dude, something's going on here where it feels slightly predatory, you know? Making music is a very intimate experience. We have like, you know, we're in a room. There's three of us sitting in this room. It's like we're, you know, there are people that can do that in a writing situation or recording situation, but they're actually, their aim is to take over everyone else's career that's in this room and steal from them. It's bizarre. It's really dark, but it's, you know, there's a book called Art of War, which I have not read. But Art of War says, you know, make friends with your enemies. Yeah. And, do all this, you know, stuff that whoever wrote that book understands what I'm talking about far better than I ever will, with like the weird hiccups in our brain that feel like, oh, this is comfortable. This is the people that are stealing from creative people in the music business. They just innately understand that. They get that people like me are kind of like, oh, you're a friendly person. This is a respectful environment. We're not going to screw each other over. You know, we're bizarre animals. It's so weird to not get the penny drop that when you treat somebody else badly or disrespectfully, it affects you.
Yep.
You're throwing, you know, you're polluting your own backyard.
Yeah. We're going to go to this next segment where I'm going to list five things. You're just going to tell me the first thing that comes off the top of your head.
This could be scary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to start with the castle in France.
Mm. Just like random whatever.
Yeah. I mean, there really aren't any.
Changed everything for me. Narcissistically changed everything for me.
Can you elaborate a little bit?
It's just, I've had 40 million sales of songs I've written at the castle. I have met two wives at the castle.
Crazy.
It's true. It's just been, you know, it took me from Miles Copeland inviting me there. I wasn't really a songwriter the first time I went and kept walking around going, why am I here? What am I doing? And didn't have that great a time. And then second time I went back, which is when I met Carol, who wound up becoming my mother-in-law, because on the third castle, she brought her daughter, Louise Goffin, as a singer-songwriter to the castle. And that's when Louise and I knew Carol first. But, you know, just meeting Carole King was like, that was a total life changer professionally with that song. And then certainly meeting her daughter. Now we have two children together and she's Grandma Carol to those kids. Like, but it taught me, Miles' belief in me as a young musician who was starting to become a songwriter was huge, and putting me in the room with people like Paul Brady from Ireland or Carole King or Mark Hudson or Gary Burr from Nashville or just tons of people that I would not have had access to otherwise. Peter Murphy from Bauhaus. Like, it's a long list.
How about Nina, your wife?
We met at the castle.
Yeah.
We actually met 10 years ago at my studio for a 4-hour writing session.
Oh, nice.
I was working with Pink on a couple of things, and one of Pink's managers said, I'm managing a writer from London who's in town for a couple of weeks. I think you guys would be a good fit. Do you want to try? And I said, I have a 4-hour window this one day. And if she can do it, that's great. If not, I can't. There's too much happening. She did. And we met, and the song wasn't very good. But by the end of that session, I thought, oh, who's this? Yeah. Who's this? And Louise and I had just ended an 11-year relationship. And so it was like 2 weeks before that. And the last thing I wanted to do is even think about women or meet anyone that was kind of interesting. And I actually had my back to Nina for the first couple hours of that session, because I had a little, like a desk like that. And she was sitting on the couch behind me and we were talking, but I wasn't looking at her. And then we ate some lunch and I'm like, oh, I think you're one of the coolest people I've ever met. But again, the castle is what really sparked that, because years later, she got invited by Sue Drew, who was running the ASCAP version of the castle, when Sue was at ASCAP before she was a COBOL. And there was Nina, and I hadn't seen her in a number of years, and our lives had changed a lot. We both had different partners, and we had a child with that partner, and it's a long story. That's like a whole other podcast, but the castle was just like a total washing machine of reinvention and invention.
Yeah. Katy Perry.
Brilliant sweetheart. One of the best songwriters I've ever written with. Everyone thinks she's handed a script. That is such BS. She drives. Yeah, how you were describing Celine earlier, Katie's very similar. She tells people like me, people like Max, she tells the producers what she wants the sounds to be, what the drum sounds should be, what they shouldn't be, a lot of what they shouldn't be. Tells the record company what the first single is, tells her management who's directing the video. She drives. And she was like that on the first album we were making together. And, you know, I'm texting her right now asking her, what's a good watch I should buy? Like, we're just, you know, we're friends. We just wrote a big Christmas song together for Amazon.
Yeah, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We still work together. She's a good egg. She is so talented. Specifically as a songwriter, actually. She's an incredible writer.
I know this is a weird one, but I know you've been working with her really since people started finding about her, and she's so young that Grace VanderWaal.
Oh, Grace is a volcano of talent.
Yeah. And then the last one, your dad.
Just random. I could start crying. Let's start there. A huge influence. And I feel like probably what I'm trying to do musically is a sort of a musical version of the kind of message that he would talk about a lot, because he was a very progressive preacher. He was in the early 1980s in a redneck town in rural Canada. He was advocating for ordaining gay ministers. He was saying women should have a right to choose. He was anti-capital punishment, all these things that did not play very well in kind of a blue-collar working town. You know, he had a lot of enemies. We'd get phone calls at 2 a.m. from people that were drunk and furious, like, how can you, those gay people coming into the church? And, you know, they didn't have a bad Southern accent like I just did, but they were like angry and irate. And he would get up, he'd wake up and he'd talk to them for an hour. And he started a call-in, a free hotline for mental health, his idea. He did all kinds of stuff, like helping people and trying to make the message of, he used to say this thing about, I'm not really religious at this point because I grew up in organized religion and I was a church organist all through my teens and it became a job for me. So I fried on organized religion, but I still in my own way, I don't really know what's going on, but I'm open to, I feel spiritual things and I love the idea of something that we don't understand that's bigger than all of this. But he would try to demystify all that. And he would say people, when they're reading, you know, any religious readings, they get so caught up in the words of God, but they should really try to plug into the word of God and make it modern and make it apply to today. So he would rarely quote the Bible. He would talk about things that had happened that week politically or just in the news and sort of make it a live, trying to make these amazing stories and parables real for today's situations. And he had this great ability to sort of like flick a light switch on to people, often through humor, but humor tethered to like really powerful truths. But there's sometimes, you know, hard, painful truths. Life's hard. It's supposed to be hard. Music is a very, very powerful, transformative thing. I still don't quite understand what music is, even though in one sense I know too much about it. But I don't know what it is, you know, and it's changed my life and I see the power of it out in the world. Look at Greatest Showman, you know, it's easy to make fun of what Greatest Showman is, but it's great songs that are just telling the truth. They're not trying to be cool. They're not trying to do anything other than tell the story of the underdog in this movie. This whole movie is about underdogs and literally freaks who were shunned from a very racist society in like upper class New York in the 1800s. And, you know, there's an interracial marriage in the movie, which I'm in one now, and that resonated with me. And just, it's a powerful thing. It's an amazing vehicle for storytelling, you know, affixing words to melody over harmony and rhythm. Can anyone show me a better idea than that? You know, it's the thing I chase every day.
Well, first of all, thank you for doing this podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You know, for a top liner and for a songwriter to get to walk into a studio that has real instruments and more importantly, a real instrumentalist to play them is a serious pleasure because there are a lot of people who can play piano, but they're limited because of just either instinct or lack of education or whatever it is. But there seems to be no limit to what someone can write with you. And if you're in the room with you, you recognize that. And, you know, I know watching you write in a room and produce in a room is such a pleasure because you have such a knowledge of how music is made and compositionally you're pulling from so many different genres. And, you know, the fact that we can talk about Katy Perry or Stephen Schwartz or Pasek & Paul or Alex Lacamoire in the same way we're talking about Ryan Tedder or Aerosmith. I mean, there aren't that many musicians in LA that are concerned with music in so many different genres, let alone all the jazz and all that. But, I just appreciate your intellect and your knowledge about music and your instincts as a producer and as a writer. And this was enjoyable. Thank you.
Okay, hold on. You're not getting off that easy. I am dead in the water without someone like you in the room. Like complete, I've got nothing. My toolbox is invisible. It's like it may as well not exist. In fact, that toolbox can impede and snuff out the flame of a great idea showing up. You know, so if there's anything that I have a talent at, I think it's being an accompanist. That's what I started doing, you know, my dad's church, like accompanying singers, accompanying choirs. If I have nothing to accompany, which is my role, then I'm like, what am I doing? You know, that's why I hate like tracks being made first and people sending out tracks. Like you're sending out accompaniment to a song that isn't written yet. It just seems, you know.
There's a great Savin quote that I've mentioned a few times. Savin said, it's like writing a screenplay to special effects. And I mean,
that's exactly it.
You know, the more fleshed out that track is, the worse song you're going to get.
But storytelling yeah. is the thing, you know.
Absolutely.
And Steven Tyler from Aerosmith to Stephen Schwartz, who wrote Wicked and Godspell and lots of other stuff, to OTEP, to Grace VanderWaal, to Chino Moreno from the Deftones, to whoever I'm lucky enough to be in the room with. There, it's all theater in their own way. It's their own version of theater. And theater is just another vehicle for storytelling. It's storytelling. So, you know, when you sit down, Ross, and you're like pen to paper and you are doing your thing and you're emoting on the microphone, you are telling this really, or when I see you in The Wrong Man, it's like you're telling this story that resonates so strongly with you. You know, you're not pandering. You're not, we didn't write Small World from a place of like, oh, I think this might be a hit with this demographic and on Mars. Like we wrote from a place of we must chase this idea. So that's the only thing I listen for and wait till I feel that feeling. And it can be like a little tiny little like bell ringing in another room, or it can be this huge gut feeling in my stomach. But I got to feel like we're doing something that matters to us. And if it matters to us and rings true to us, it's going to find an audience. Sorry, I'm making a whole bunch of points right now, but I'm just saying that it's really generous and makes me all awkward, nervous to hear you say these nice things about me. But I'm telling you, my skill set doesn't exist unless I get to, you know, collaborate with a really brilliant storyteller. And then it's apparent to me what I can do to help that story move along. But I can't come up with the story. If I do, it's not going to be very good, you know.
Well, you came up with a story for the last hour and a half.
I've been trying.
So on that note, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. This.
All right, cool. Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.